This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a new California prison program that has inmates' families worried for their safety.
Inmates were stabbed, beaten with locks. They were sent to administrative segregation, which is the hole.
And later, one Central Coast farmer used to be a well-known local chef. She may have left the restaurant world behind, but she's still particular about the meals she prepares.
I don't like something that I'll get bored of like halfway through. I like when each bite brings you something different. Otherwise, you're just finishing your plate.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon and Happy New Year. It's Monday, January 7th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Love him or hate him, Jerry Brown was one of a kind. The man whose record fourth term as California governor came to an end today has always relished reeling off Latin quotes and obscure literary and historical references. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler offers up this reporter's notebook of some of Brown's more memorable and entertaining quips during his final stint as governor.
You might expect a drop in entertainment value when a movie star leaves the governor's office. But Jerry Brown took California politics from Arnold Schwarzenegger's
"I'll be back"
to Latin.
I've often used the phrase from Thomas Hobbes, bellum omnes contra omnes, bellum omni contra omnes.
That was Brown quoting a 17th century English philosopher during his state budget update in May 2011, back when California faced a $27 billion deficit. He was urging Republicans to strike a deal that would let voters decide whether to extend expiring tax increases. Otherwise, he translated,
"War of all against all. It will be, everyone will retreat to their corner and devise strategies on what California does."
There was no deal, so later that year, after signing a budget with trigger cuts, if state revenues came in below projections, Brown again turned to Latin.
There's a very simple, I wanted to invoke a Latin phrase here, nemo dat non habet. It means no man gives what he does not have. The state cannot give what it does not have.
The full quote is actually nemo dat quod non habet. Sorry for my Latin pronunciation. But the governor used it in context. The state didn't have the money, so it couldn't spend it. Brown would also sprinkle in little quips when speaking off the cuff. For example, in September of 2011, as he was slogging through hundreds of bills on his desk,
"Not every human problem needs a law."
A statement he sometimes echoed in his veto messages, which themselves were often quite entertaining. And last month, at the Sacramento Press Club, he put forth perhaps the most Jerry Brown quote ever.
"I'm not here to make news. I'm here to enlighten you."
As for literary and historical references, you'd be hard-pressed to top the 20 that Brown weaved into his 2013 State of the State Address.
"Oliver Wendell Holmes' Genesis. Then the lean cows ate up the fat cows. The Pharaoh took the advice of Joseph Franklin Roosevelt, a rendezvous with destiny. Remember how California began. King Charles III, Jose de Galvez, Gaspar Portola, flesh of emaciated pack mules, El Camino Real, the King's Highway. Father Serra, President Lincoln, the Transcontinental Railroad, and land-grant colleges. Montaigne, the great French writer of the 16th century. The Ten Commandments, quiz bits, William Butler Yeats, the principle of subsidiarity, a little engine that could."
That's right, 20. And in his 2017 State of the State,
"Let me end in the immortal words of Woody Guthrie."
Brown quoted Guthrie's progressive folk anthem, "This Land is Your Land," as he urged a state still reeling from President Trump's election to respond with courage and perseverance.
"And here's the part I really like. Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking that freedom highway. Nobody living can ever make me turn back. This land was made for you and me. California is not turning back, not now, not ever. His truth is marching on."
That last line, an ad-lib, inserted in the moment from another famed American anthem, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
taking the reins from Jerry Brown. Democrat Gavin Newsom was sworn in as California's next governor today. On the campaign trail, he made bold promises about creating universal health care and building millions of new homes. Today, Cap Radio's PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols introduces the Newsom Meter, a project that will track the governor's top campaign pledges over the next 4 years.
There was no shortage of promises made by Newsom on the campaign trail.
Guaranteed health care for all, a Marshall Plan for affordable housing, a master plan for aging with dignity, a middle-class workforce strategy, a cradle-to-college promise for the next generation.
We'll track those promises and also Newsom's commitment to create free community college in the state, to launch college savings accounts for every kindergartner, to protect California's coastline from expanded offshore oil drilling. In all, our Newsom Meter project will follow 12 promises and offer regular updates on their progress, or lack thereof. Ultimately, we'll rate each as kept, broken, or compromised. Republican political strategist Mike Madrid says Newsom's pledge to help create 3.5 million new housing units over the next 6 years might just be his most audacious.
Is it achievable? It's certainly possible. It is, but highly unlikely.
In the meantime, we'll be watching to see whether the governor keeps his
promises, promises.
In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. A series of riots took place at a Central Coast prison at the end of 2018. Officials at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation say prison fights broke out at Soledad State Prison just before the Christmas holiday. 4 inmates were hospitalized. CDCR officials say they are minor incidents, but families of inmates say more fights are occurring because of a new state prison program.
Our families are being tortured. Most of these men, they have worked hard to go to level 1 and level 2 facilities. It's as though they're being punished for all the hard work they've invested in themselves.
That's Darlene Burke at a protest outside the CDCR headquarters in Sacramento last month. The level 1 and level 2 facilities she mentions, those are security classifications. Basically, while serving time, inmates are assigned points and then work them off to downgrade security levels. The lower the number, the more privileges offered and better chances to receive parole. But get in trouble, and that chance decreases.
People are being denied their suitability to parole back into community because they are being forced to integrate and being forced to keep themselves safe.
The integration Burke is talking about has to do with sensitive needs yards, or SNYs. For 20 years, sensitive needs inmates have been separated from the general population for their own safety, often for being informants. But California now has the largest protective custody prison population in the nation. To mitigate this, the CDCR has begun merging the two yards together at level 1 and level 2 facilities around the state, calling them non-designated programming facilities, or NDPFs. It started as a voluntary program for inmates that are programming well. That means getting
self-help education and no write-ups. They're just programming to go home.
Ruthie Montalvo has been organizing protests of the NDPFs because now the program is mandatory. Her husband is an inmate, and she says the two groups of inmates, GPs and SNYs, are stigmatized to hate each other. She says the integrations are putting inmates at risk for getting attacked, like an incident this summer at North Kern State Prison.
Those inmates were stabbed, beaten with locks. Basically, they were taken to medical, and once they were treated, they were sent to administrative segregation, which is the hole.
Montalvo says inmates have become fearful of integrations. She says some start the fights hoping to get sent to the hole or get moved out of a prison entirely, which would hurt their chances of parole, but possibly keeping them safer. KCBX News reviewed a number of rules violation reports for riots that occurred at North Kern and others in 2018. They don't cite the causes, but do describe GP and SNY inmates fighting each other in yards and dorms, officers firing expulsion grenades, pepper spray, and direct impact rounds into crowds. They also include photos of inmates with lacerations and contusions on their faces and bodies. Ralph Diaz is the acting secretary of the CDCR.
Just like any change, there have been incidents that have occurred at some prisons, but not to the magnitude that would warrant us to change or stop at this point.
Diaz says CDCR officials integrate inmates on a case-by-case basis.
Each inmate sits in front of a committee. It's explained why it would benefit them. We cannot have inmates just fill out and say, I'm not going to go, without any documentation that we can validate through their file or even as we discuss with them.
Diaz says while he won't put inmates on yards with documented enemies, inmates are going to need to learn to get along moving forward. Diaz says the CDCR's goal is to give more inmates more quote-unquote programming opportunities aimed at getting them out sooner.
Because eventually they're going to go home and they need to be equipped and educated and trained and provided skills. But if certain segments of inmates can't go there because one particular group doesn't like them, fundamentally that's wrong.
Montalvo says the programming opportunities in the CDCR have worked for her husband.
He's worked so hard. He's serving a 21-year, 4-month sentence, and my husband has completely turned his life around. He deserves that opportunity to come home to his family.
Montalvo says Avenal State Prison, where her husband is currently an inmate, is set to integrate at the beginning of the year. She worries that an integration incident could hurt his chances for release, or worse.
There is no bigger fear than finding out that something has happened in a prison. You're left with your thoughts to ponder. Is my husband dead? Is he alive? Is what happened?
Montalvo and a group of protesters met with Ralph Diaz in November, and while Diaz says he heard their concerns, he says he still has no plans to halt the program. Montalvo says she and the loved ones of inmates will keep protesting. If you have any information about the implementation of the NDPF program, or you are concerned about someone currently incarcerated in a California prison, send us an email at news@kcbx.org, and we will keep reporting on this. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. A federal agency is taking public comment right now on a plan to lease areas offshore of California's coast to wind energy development. A handful of companies are jockeying to win the right to build wind farms out at sea. Proposed for areas about 20 miles off Morro Bay or Avila Beach, the farms would consist of dozens of connected floating turbines generating electricity sent back to shore and the energy grid via a seafloor cable. The public comment period ends at the end of the month, and as KCBX's Greta Mart reports, not even renewable energy proposals escape controversy and criticism.
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is also known as BOEM. It's an agency under the Interior Department, and it's in charge of leasing areas off America's coast, whether it's for gas and oil exploration or renewable energy projects. BOEM and the California Energy Commission have released maps of possible lease areas off California's coast. There are just three areas that have all the necessary components. Those are off the coast of Diablo Canyon Power Plant, off the coast of Morro Bay, and offshore Humboldt County near Eureka.
There's limited places offshore California where you can actually do offshore wind energy. You need greater than 7 meters per second wind speed for it to be economically viable for a developer to even want to put a project in. So looking at the cost-benefit analysis, that's the kind of the cutoff point.
Jean Thurston is a renewable energy specialist for BOEM. She says other considerations in figuring out where an offshore wind farm could go are water depth and finding areas that aren't in a marine sanctuary. In the end, just 6% of California's offshore areas have the right conditions. And besides the technical needs, there's other users to try to get on board.
We want to pick areas that minimize conflict. Now we know, looking at all the areas offshore that are viable, there's no area that's going to be conflict-free. So we're trying to look at areas that have the least amount of conflict.
Groups that oppose setting up offshore wind farms are the fishing industry and the shipping industry. And then there's people who say the wind farms will harm marine mammals, like migrating whales, due to dangers of entanglement and undersea noise. For the area off Morro Bay, local fishermen have made an agreement with one of the wind energy developers, says Eric Enderby, Morro Bay's harbor director.
The fishing community is supportive. The fishing community has signed on to an agreement with Castle Winds, the proponent that's pushing one of the projects right now. It will impact the fishing community because it's basically taking some fishing grounds off limits where they won't be able to fish. And so they've mitigated that, and the fishermen are happy with what they've agreed with Castle Winds.
The search for possible offshore wind energy development areas started with a proposal from a company named Trident Winds, now known as Castle Winds. That application kicked off a whole planning process with the state and federal government to look at offshore wind energy in California.
So instead of just responding to requests site specifically, why don't we as a state look at where the wind resources are and where the need is and where the most environmentally sensitive areas are to avoid and really think about where we would want offshore wind if we were to approve a project.
Kristen Hislop is with the Environmental Defense Center. The center has been active in the process of figuring out where offshore leases should go from an environmental stance. They've submitted ideas on the type of research, studies, and monitoring efforts that are necessary to protect the marine environment.
We haven't taken a stance on whether or not we're for or against offshore wind, but we are very interested in being part of the process and figuring out if we can help influence in a positive way where these things might be sited and also determine if it's the best way to get renewable energy for the state.
In mid-December, BOEM held an open house in San Luis Obispo to answer questions from the public. A few dozen people showed up to speak to staff from various agencies involved in the decision-making process and submit public comment.
Someone knows a lot about the birds in the area. Someone knows a lot about the whales. We want to hear from them, a lot about who fishes where in the area.
Frank Pendleton does mapping for BOEM.
We're opening the comment period now. That's what we want to hear from folks, how this could affect them.
The public comment period ends January 28th. We'll put up a link when we post this story to our website at kcbx.org. For KCBX News, I'm Greta Mart.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Taylor Pratt. Slow Night Writers is a San Luis Obispo County-based group of authors, poets, and screenwriters. Its mission is to advance quality writing, promote publication, and expand author recognition in a forum that nurtures a spirit of community for all its members. And the group meets monthly in San Luis Obispo. In this next segment, correspondent Tom Woolmer visits with Slow Night Writers board member Pat Geimer.
I'm Tom Woolmer. Join me as we visit with Pat Geimer. Pat's involved in the Slow Night Riders. I have to admit, when I first heard about the Night Riders, I thought you guys were a motorcycle gang. I thought you were the riding around at night on your Harleys.
Different kind of rider.
So then I find out that you're a writer, that you guys do books and poetry and all kinds of things. Tell us about the organization.
Well, it's really a place where you can get support and feel like you're in the company of other writers. We have monthly meetings for the general membership. We have guest speakers, lots of critique groups. I am the critique group coordinator, so I've been going around since I've had that role and just sitting in on different critique groups and getting a feel for how things are done. And when someone's asking for a critique group, I try to hook them up with one that works for them.
How many people typically attend a monthly meeting and where they're from and what they do in general?
We have people who come from as far away as Napomo, sometimes Santa Maria.
And Paso, I know.
Yeah. All the way north.
You meet in San Luis Obispo?
We meet in San Luis Obispo.
On Los Osos Valley Road still?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
At the church.
Which church?
We meet at the United Church of Christ on Los Osos Valley Road.
And your meetings are in the evening, correct?
Yes, the second Tuesday evening of each month.
How many people on average would attend?
Between 30 and 50.
Oh, wow, that's a viable organization.
I would like to think so, yeah.
But you're always open to new people joining.
Yes, and we look for them. They get to wear a different sticker with their name on it that highlights the fact that they're a guest. And then we try to seek them out and entice them to join.
Give us an example of a thematic meeting that you might have.
Often about how to get published, things to look out for, when you're going through the motions. Sometimes we've had things about storytelling, where people can get up and verbally tell a story that they might write.
And then poetry. I know you do some poetry.
I do. I do poetry. Poetry was the first kind of writing that I did, and I've gradually moved into other longer pages of things like short stories and novel
Let's say, for example, I'm a writer, and one of the reasons that I or you would want to join a group is not only for that moral support, but for the help and the feedback. How does that work as far as learning from the others?
The technical aspects of writing, yes. Well, there are lots of people who are very experienced and have many books published, and they will sometimes come and share their mistakes and their successes in getting through the process.
I was guest speaker at your group a couple of years ago, and as I remember, there was some tutorial and some surgical information about screenwriting. Do you remember that?
Yes. Oh, I think that might have been Dennis Palumbo. Yeah, I remember him talking about screenwriting in particular, but also that any writer could use those techniques and actually visualize a scene as they write, and make sure that the reader can visualize it as well.
So even though you're not writing a movie, it still works as a very visual tool.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me another aspect of why you like slow night writers and why you like going to the meetings and why it's valuable to you.
Okay. What I get out of them is a chance to benefit from the guest speakers.
From their knowledge and expertise you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. And it's really just fun to get together with everybody. I often will sit in the critique group that's offered. There are a couple of critique groups that are offered ahead of the meeting. If you go at 5:15, you can get signed into a critique group and do an on-the-spot critique. One group has the different members critiquing, and the other group is a couple of published authors who critique it.
Anything you want to add? Now's your time.
Come on out and join us. Anybody who's interested in writing is always welcome to join us and meet us and see what we have to offer. You can also go on the website, Slow Night Writers. You can look at different meetings that were archived in the past, all kinds of things, information there, helpful information on our website. What helps me the most, the most benefit that I get from night writers, is being part of their critique groups. I happen to be in a really good one. I've been in other ones in the past, just equally as good, one for poetry and another for fiction writing. But it keeps me writing more than I might do otherwise because I don't get distracted. I know I have a deadline and I need to show up with something to be critiqued.
And the criticism is inevitably valuable to you, I presume.
It is. It's always kind of sandwiched in between some compliments, but in the middle is something really valuable that you need to hear to improve your writing.
Before we go, talk a little bit about recruiting and outreach to new people that might want to come.
Well, we are part of the Central Coast Writers Conference.
Cuesta College.
At Cuesta College, yes. And that's one of the ways that we try to recruit people and let them know about our organization. I mean, we'll have our names on the water bottles, and we have many of our members doing presentations and speaking. But we really want to invite you because we'd love to grow our membership and serve the need that newer writers might have to find a home where they can associate with other writers. Also, if you're interested in serving on the board, we would love to have you join the board in any capacity that you are interested in to help our membership increase and our group grow in its ability to serve the community.
Pat Geimer, thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
If you're interested in becoming a slow night writer, there will be a meeting tomorrow at the United Church of Christ in San Luis Obispo. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll talk food and wine. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. We're going to spend the second half of the show getting to know a local winemaker and a local chef turned farmer. The first segment comes to us again from our travel correspondent, Tom Wilmer. Then in part two, a new segment called Consumed from local food writer, Jamie Lewis. We hope you enjoy.
Here we are in the valley with Mike Seiner, and your company is?
Seiner La Valley Wine Company.
Mike, you go way back into the prehistoric days of winemaking in the California Central Coast.
91, 92 is my first vintage here in the Edna Valley.
You were Cal Poly when?
I was in Cal Poly about 90 through 94. Okay. My time here.
Right, so you're a puppy, but still the olden days in Central Coast winemaking.
For sure. At that time, we had about five wineries in the Edna Valley and about 14 wineries in Paso Robles at the time.
And game changer today you have?
Today, Paso Robles is north of 300 wineries. Edna, Arroyo Grande, Slow Wine Country, we've got about 30.
Talk to us about your operation here and what you do. Do you grow all estate-grown grapes, or do you source from wherever is fair game?
Yeah, so for our company, Seiner La Valley, we're 100% estate-grown fruit. So my wife and I were able to buy a vineyard in Avila Beach. Our ranch is about 1.2 miles from the ocean, and there we grow 30 acres of grapes, and wow. That's what we make for our company.
What does best out there?
You know, Pinot Noir is definitely what we've kind of been known for since we started the company back in 1997. But we do Chardonnay, Syrah, we do Pinot Gris, a little bit of Albarino, and I just put some new Grenache in. We're going to get this year, calendar year vintage of 2018, we'll get our first crop.
Talk to us about processing, picking, and how you determine when and then what.
It's really about feel. You know, we do look at some numbers, chemistries, but I spend a lot of time in the fields. I'm tasting the fruit and relying upon my instinct and experience to say when to pick.
So taste and instinct rules and numbers just confirm what you did?
Exactly. And then just looking at the vine itself. I mean, you can pick up just a matter of clues from the vine when you see it. With
the leaf.
The leaf, how it angles of the leaf from the rachises to the lignification of the stems and stuff. All that, there is a lot of things to look at that can help you understand where it's at.
Talk to us about philosophy of growing / organic and that purist approach and why you do what you do there.
Yeah, you know, traveling around the world, my wife and I got married in Burgundy in 96, and I've spent a fair amount of time in Europe in Burgundy learning from people. I worked for Robert Mondavi. Around the world, when I met some of the best winemakers of the world, they tended to focus on the vineyards, and they tended to be organic, biodynamic practitioners. So literally, that's where it got to me, why I started delving in those philosophies and training, because those people, I love their wines, and I wanted to be like that when I grew up. So that's what brought me to it.
From a blind standpoint, can you tell the difference, whether it's organic or not?
You know, from a wine itself, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not a super taster. I'm not a master sommelier. I'm just a small business owner, farmer. But I have seen over time, though, that wines are just a little more complex. There is that, say, je ne sais quoi, right? There's that, and very often those farming practices has that. So yeah, I know it makes a big difference in the wine.
Here we are. This is your winery. This is where you do all of your processing.
This is, you know, I actually rent space here. We're currently sitting here at a company called Center of Effort in the Edna Valley, and we rent about 2,000 square foot of space with which to create our wines.
And how about retail, and how would somebody come and experience your wine?
Certainly. We've got a small tasting room in Avila Beach, one block from the ocean, 550 First Street in Avila Beach, California. And we're open 5 days a week. And yeah, we're there to pour some wines and share our story.
I'm sure you've got a wine club.
We do. We're still a pretty small winery. We're less than 2,000 cases for Seiner La Valley. Plus, we've been in the game since 97. And we've got some great accolades. So yeah, we have a good, strong wine club, and most of our wines are sold directly, but we're also distributed in California with Henry Wine Group. You will find our wines all over California in small select shops and restaurants.
Okay, let's go back in time and the bigger picture and what made you who you are today outside of Europe in your time there was being embedded in Edna Valley in the county. So talk about some of the early iterations and where your eyes were opened and why and how.
I just had to work a lot. That's kind of where I came from in the San Joaquin Valley. And so I got here with no wine background. And then a friend of mine said, hey, we're hiring in a tasting room at the old Corbett Canyon Winery.
Were you still at Cal Poly at that time?
I just got to Cal Poly. I was there.
And were you an ag major?
I was industrial technology. I wanted to teach shop class. I wanted to teach high school metal shop.
Oh, the guys with three fingers?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. My father had an auto dismantling yard in the valley, and I grew up very physical. And that's what I wanted to do, but I had to work. So a friend of mine got me an interview at Corbett Canyon Winery, and within a month, I just realized how great this business was, how the local scene was just amazing.
I need to interrupt for a moment because younger people don't even know what Corbett Canyon Winery was or that it was. What put San Luis Obispo County on the map for a lot of people around the country back in the day?
Oh, without a doubt. There's a lot of famous winemakers in California that worked here. You know, in charge of winemaking, but Justin Winery worked here, Cambria Winery, Farniente is up there. You know, I mean, it was a bigger winery. It's distributed in every state in the country, and it was just a kind of an anchor for the valley.
And it had national ads
on TV. Oh,
okay, go there, see if you can do it.
Canyon. Yeah, everybody remembers
the
that
echo,
stuff.
The Echo, yeah.
The Echo. That was an amazing, in fact, that's still taught in certain marketing books I've heard because it was such an impactful campaign, and it helped the company just grow to huge levels.
And what happened? Did it implode? Why?
No, it's still owned by the wine group. So they're the third largest producer of wine in this country. But most of their fruit comes from the San Joaquin Valley.
Back in the day, again, I mean, this is a place where you come to the tasting room and whatnot for Corbett Canyon Winery. It doesn't have that local presence anymore.
No, Corbett does not anymore. A lot of the wines, like I said, come from the San Joaquin Valley or from Chile or wherever they can get it from. It's a big bulk. The wine's just a good everyday wine still.
Grocery store wine.
It's a grocery store wine. And probably 10 to 12 countries in every state in our country.
Interesting, huh? And it all started right here.
It did. And that's how I first got in. But to your question about where I found my direction, really was the small players here. Saucito Canyon, the Greeno family.
So you work with Tom, the son?
I used to babysit Tom, actually. Yeah, I did. So that was part of my background here. I worked for six wineries in the Edna Valley, and Tom and Margaret were pretty young back in the day, and Bill and Nancy asked me to babysit them. I said, sure, and I house it for them. But I saw Claiborne and Churchill. I saw Celestial Canyon, Pierre Creek, Romeo, and Margaret, and I thought, what a wonderful lifestyle. I want to do this, and I've dedicated myself to do it ever since.
Talk a little bit about organic and being an environmental steward. This is something that you don't have to do, but you choose to do.
Certainly. You know, it's something that I've been working on for a long time, and it really goes back to making wines of place. You know, that's really the reason for being, is make wine that speaks of place. And so when you use less chemicals, it has a better resulting of speaking of place. And so that's what brought me to organic and biodynamic farming. And so as we sit here today, right here, we're looking at this pumice. This is Pinot Noir that we just shoveled out of the tank today. I've got it in my trailer right here in front of us. And we're going to drive that back to the vineyard and make our own compost pile and eventually integrate that back into the field.
Let's talk about yeast for a moment. There are some that do 100% native yeast that don't add any. There are others that won't go there and add yeast to every single batch.
I'm about half native fermentation, so for me, yeast is an interesting aspect to winemaking, but for me, the overriding philosophy is to make the wine as complex as possible as early as possible. So one of my ways of doing that is changing up the yeast protocol.
So you're manipulating and tweaking the taste profile then?
Without a doubt. We just harvested five fermenters yesterday. Those five fermenters, three are going to be native, and two of them are going to be two different yeasts.
Oh, so it'd be neat to do some side-by-side, huh?
And that's what we do. Again, it's making the wine as complex as possible, as early as possible. Native always gives me a richness and a texture and this kind of earthy flavor that really attracts me. But I like using Osmanhausen as one of my main yeasts for Pinot Noir out of Switzerland, and there's a really nice fruity character to the wine. And then we're going to come back later, and I'll blend my wines to what I like.
Let's go back to your early days, Cal Poly. What did you learn? Was it worth going to Cal Poly? What did you walk away with that was the most beneficial?
You know, yeah, I learned a lot of Cal. I loved going to school there. I thought it was a wonderful school. I thought they imparted into me and my friends a little more of a humbleness and realized that, hey, look, school brings you vocabulary, but it doesn't teach you how to do it. You don't graduate a doctor or a teacher. Right. You graduate now you have the basics of how to learn. And that was taught through us, I think, driven through us. I think it was really great. And so I love that.
Learn by doing was a part of the program in the day.
Without a doubt. And so, and having six part-time jobs going through Cal Poly was definitely my learn by doing in wine. And but I decided to stick it out. There was a time I thought about going back to Fresno and but
Fresno State.
Fresno State, who has a wonderful program. Cal Poly at the time did not have a program here. So,
are you involved and embedded with Cal Poly's viticulture and viniculture program?
I do. I help out all I can. They call on me and the company, you know, Ancient Peaks, and myself, and we will always help out when we can. It's been exciting to see this grow. And it, in particular, seeing very famous families, Fetzers, Gallows, seeing
Jay Lohr.
You know, Randy Dunn's daughter, they go to Cal Poly. You know, they could go to Davis and Fresno. Right. Very exciting. As we sit here on the crush pad, three young people just walked by, and they're all Cal Poly kids, interns. They're already talking about it, the new winery. They call it the new winery. And so it is exciting to see that.
We make a wine called Ancestral. And you spoke about the technique called Method Champenois. That's the classic method making champagne. This technique that we're employing is called Method Ancestral. So this is how sparkling wine was made before Dom Perignon. So what we do is we harvest very early, like champagne. My finished alcohol is about 9 to 10%. I harvest early, it's Pinot Noir. I press it, and I bottle it about 2 weeks after I harvest it. It's finished.
And it's ready to drink.
And it's ready, it has to ferment in that bottle. I never added any yeast. I never added any SO2. No riddling, it's cloudy. And so, but I like to sit them outside and get them nice and warmed up. And we generally release that wine about a month after we bottle it. It's more like a cider than it is a wine.
What's the bubbly character?
You know, it's champagne's little cousin, you know, crazy little cousin is what it is. So you don't get the fine bubbles. It's not a refined taste. It's more of a bottle conditioned cider is what it is. There's solids and there's turbidity in the liquid in the wine, but it's fun. It's super high in acidity. It's super low in alcohol. It's a fun, it's not a serious wine. And so the French would say the wine, when they look at it and say, hey, is a Petrillon Natural. And so the hipsters in California call it Pet Nat. So we started experimenting in the 15 vintage. At that time, I knew of about three in California. Now it is becoming, I bet there's at least 15, and it's a very right now experience. Back to your question about cash flow and owning a vineyard, it's important to get something to the market soon, and it's a perfect wine to do that.
Quick turnaround.
It is a, you know, it's a game changer. Beer, right? You get on the phone and you call the hops and you call the barley and you call everybody and they bring it in and they make it. It's vodka's the same way. We have one time a year to get our raw product, and that's generally a 2 or 3 year lag time. Suddenly I'm in market 3 months after I harvested. It works really well. Fun to find new stuff. For us, I think that's been one of our, it's a porch pounder. Tom, by all means, man. When it's summertime and it's a warm day, they're fun wines. Again, 9% alcohol. It's not sit around and contemplate world philosophies. It's enjoy it and have a nice lunch, get back to work.
Thanks for visiting, Mike. What a pleasure. It's always a joy to visit with somebody with such passion for the grape.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it and appreciate coming out and seeing vintage.
If somebody wanted to learn more about you, once again, name of your winery and a website.
The company is called Signor La Valle, and you can go to SINORLAVALLEE.com is our website, or just go to Google. Mike Signor Winemaker does pretty well. My mom loves that.
All right, thanks, Mom. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Edna Valley, California.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. That was Tom Wilmer speaking with winemaker Mike Signor. Now here's Central Coast food writer Jamie Lewis with her new segment for KCBX called Consumed.
At just 5 feet tall and 31 years old, Julie Simon does not look like your typical farmer. But then again, she's never done things the prescribed way. Most locals know Julie as Chef Julie, the Wunderkind executive chef behind Thomas Hill Organics restaurant in Paso Robles, and most recently, Foremost in downtown SLO, which has since closed. Her vibrant global cuisine helped usher in the farm-to-table movement in SLO County and push the boundaries on what and how we locals eat. In the process, she also brought up the next wave of culinary talent, people like Kenny Bigwood, who worked in the kitchen with Julie at both Thomas Hill and Foremost. Today, he's executive chef at Granada Bistro in SLO.
You can tell the amount of effort and love that she puts in everything that she does. She taught me everything that I know about working in a professional kitchen and in a restaurant. I came from nothing, and everything I do every day is probably taught to me by her at some point in the past.
Or there's Kyle Rucker, the executive chef at Sidecar in SLO, who cooked with Julie at Foremost for 2.5 years, which he calls
probably the best industry 2.5 years of my life. When she gives you a project, you tend to excel more than you would if you were doing it yourself because you're cooking for Julie Simon. It's a different beast when you're working with Julie. It's just everything turns out how she wants it, but done by you. So you almost feel accomplished for what you did, but it was because of her.
Full disclosure, I've been a fan of Julie's food and her fearlessness for years. When word got out she'd left Foremost to start a farm of all things, I was intrigued. What would make a young chef want to ditch the industry at the top of her game?
Anouk, it's okay. It's okay.
I meet Julie on a bright fall morning out at her farm, which she likes to call her garden. In baggy khakis and a white tank top, she greets me with an armful of firecracker dahlias and her little dog Anouk, who looks sideways at me from beside Julie's leg.
Don't get close to Julie. Got it.
Planted entirely by Julie herself, the garden surrounds a mirror pond with a weeping willow tree at its center. The water reflects rows of black Aztec corn, crawling with melon vines that Julie has planted together in an Indian style of permaculture she's trying out. Flowers, peppers, onions, herbs, melons, and squash radiate out in concentric circles around the pond, warming their leaves as the sun rises. We sit on a vintage sofa in the tomato patch, which I realize is a perfect representation of Julie herself, elegant and rugged, all at the same time, a style she says comes from growing up in two very different environments in her native France.
I would say that I had two very strong upbringings. I was born in Paris in a rather privileged home and, you know, going to private school and having country homes and in a very eclectic town, right? A lot of culture, very eccentric family. And then later on, and still within my childhood, we moved to the southwest of France, which was much more rural, small community, not a whole lot of happenings, big farming community. And it's kind of funny, you're a byproduct of your environment, right? Yeah. So I definitely believe that I inherited both of those worlds. It took me a while to understand which one I identified the most with. And I kept on going back and forth for a long time. How do you want to live your life, you know? And I realized that you can be both.
Julie's connection to the U.S. begins with her grandfather, who was American and blessed much of her family with dual citizenship, including her aunt and uncle, who had used it to relocate to California. In the meantime, back in France, Julie left home for university in Bordeaux, where she planned to study law. But that plan didn't exactly pan out.
You know that you have to do your part, and I mean, I consider myself a relatively intelligent person, mm-hmm. But at the same time, I needed to be a little bit more practical of a study, and I didn't get that with law. And I think they would take you many years into your studies to actually feel like you're heading some kind of direction, like maybe 8 years.
Sometime during the middle of her university studies, Julie's aunt and uncle invited her to California, where they'd settled on an olive farm in Templeton. It was an offer she couldn't refuse.
I was right about to turn 18, and I arrived with 2 suitcases. And no ambition whatsoever. And, you know, I was just going to spend a few months and I was going to learn English and I was going to get a job. And and it seemed very simple. And then where I arrived, it was not that simple.
Finding a job proved more difficult than she'd expected. But when Julie's uncle saw how eager she was in the kitchen, he suggested she find work cooking in a restaurant, a position that would have been out of her reach or unthinkable in France.
That was never something that I would have even dreamed of. You know, from where I come from, working in a kitchen is a blue-collar job. It's definitely not welcome to women, or young women for that matter. And you need some kind of skill set. And I'm so grateful that he pushed me in that direction. But back then, there was no shortage of labor in the kitchen, you know? So getting a job in the kitchen was a whole lot more difficult, especially welcoming the young French girl. It's like, what are you going to do, you know? We have a brigade of people that can work twice as hard and that can actually endure. What are you going to be doing?
Eventually, Chef Pandy Pearson got in touch with Julie for help plating desserts during the summer months at her Morro Bay restaurant, Windows on the Water. To Julie, the prospect was thrilling.
That was actually some of like the most exhilarating months ever. I can't remember like being that chipper and that excited about a job, you know? It gave you that feeling that you belong to something that was bigger. It was very busy restaurants, and especially in the summer. And it was really kind of this challenge of give as much as you can, and more often than not in very uncomfortable situation. And I don't know, you felt like you were proving your worth, really. And especially for me, I felt like I needed to prove more than the rest of them, because I didn't speak the language, because I was the outcast in so many ways. But then I look back and I was like, we're all outcasts. That's where we were so united, in fact. You know, we find each other and somehow we belong to something when all of us never really felt like we belong to anything.
Although it probably didn't feel like it to Julie at the time, her star was quickly on the rise, moving from one professional kitchen to another, and eventually moving into the role of executive chef at Thomas Hill Organics and then Foremost Wine Company. The style she became known for reflected the way she herself likes to eat.
Bold, fresh ingredients, and ethnic foods. I don't like something that I'll get bored of like halfway through. I like when each bite brings you something different. Otherwise, you're just finishing your plate. Even in Paris or in the southwest of France, we've always had access to amazing ingredients, and typically not classically beautiful ingredients. We don't have, you know, corn waxed apples and whatnot. You know, usually they're not uniform. Maybe they even have bruises on, and, you know, they're not shiny, but they taste what they're meant to be, and you only get them the season that they're available at. And that's the pillars of cooking. It's great ingredients. I've relied for a very long time on just good ingredients. That's my clutch.
Everyone, it seemed, had noticed Julie. She showed up in W Magazine when she was at Thomas Hill in an article about the emergence of Paso Robles as a legit new wine and food town. Wine Enthusiast Magazine named Foremost one of its top 100 restaurants when Julie was at the helm. But it was all getting to be a bit too much for her. And then...
I turned 30. That was huge. And I turned 30 in the Himalayas. That was huge, too. I was at a difficult time, I think, at Foremost then, because I, I was really questioning my role there and my capacity.
To celebrate her 30th birthday, Julie wanted to be far away on a mountaintop. So she and her longtime boyfriend, Tyler, both avid backpackers, bought tickets to the furthest place they could think of, Nepal.
We miss our flight. It was such an ordeal to get there. And then our first packing expedition, we get caught into a hailstorm and we run out of money on the mountain. That's a big no-no, by the way, because nobody takes Venmo, let alone find an ATM. And we realized you'd be climbing for hours with just a vague idea of where you were going to stop next. And a vague idea what the trail looked like. You know, you download a GPS map, but it's only accurate as talking about the Himalayas, right? And all of a sudden, the weather can change on you, and you're trapped in the middle of nowhere, and perhaps you'll be never found. That was not something that I knew I was signing up for going in. No clue. And, you know, it takes a few days to actually get comfortable with that idea. You could disappear and nobody will find you. And you have to be okay with it. And rather, it became like a very empowering idea, actually.
The authenticity of the Nepali people impacted Julie too.
I've never met that many families that were just genuinely happy and had nothing. I mean, they're still recovering from a devastating earthquake and they live sometimes in very, very mediocre conditions. And yet they have this life force that is astonishing. It was an amazing thing to witness, really.
Julie and Tyler made it back to SLO, but she couldn't shake the experience she'd had on that mountain. The question became,
how do we simplify our lives and how do we live a more meaningful life and still comply with the reality of our economy, you know?
She realized she needed to move on from Foremost. And soon after that, she decided she was going to start farming.
Going back to something that felt much more real.
Though she loves cooking and leading a team, Julie realized chefs are expected to do and be much more. An accountant, a PR genius, and
the face of your business, and you have to entertain and you have to fit the idea of what a chef is and what it looks like and its personality. And I was never really interested in doing that more than cooking and leading a team, really, because that's a huge part of it.
Of course. She didn't know much about farming, so when she left Foremost, she asked to become an intern with Bill and Barbara Spencer at Windrose Farm in Paso Robles.
My first week was 108 degrees, and we trellised tomatoes for a couple of days. I mean, I thought I worked hard before, but I don't remember that something that was that hard.
After 6 months, she came away from Windrose Farm with enough understanding to tackle her own project. A space between soft hills in Edna Valley, around the contours of a pond. She met the owners of the land through Kyle Rucker, her former co-worker at Foremost, and they've allowed her to irrigate, plant, and cultivate her garden as a permaculture and biodiversity experiment of sorts.
Right before I started the project, we went to visit my family and friends, brought back some heirloom seeds, varieties that I had grown up with. So I definitely put a lot of melons in the ground. And they've done really, really well, actually. Organizing the planting had a lot to do with how could I make a full dinner out of it. I know that that was kind of a guideline.
Julie also uses the garden as community-supported agriculture, with a very small group of members paying in to get a share of its harvest. She says it won't put any kids she decides to have through college, but she likes to keep it manageable at this point.
I chose to keep it simple because I want to make sure that the customers that I'm handling, I'm able to provide healthily through the whole growing season. And because I don't know exactly what that looks like yet, I just prefer to play safe so I know that I can keep them going long enough. And also, I did welcome in the CSA people that I know would be happy to grow the farm and forgiving too and understanding that some things might not come up the way we thought it would.
To Julie's surprise, she hasn't needed their forgiveness yet because the garden has thrived, which she credits to the crops themselves.
Plants are programmed to survive. So even if you mistreat them, most likely they're gonna find a way to kick back.
Still, she won't be opening the CSA to the public quite yet. The process will take time, and besides, she learned on her summit of that mountain in Nepal, success isn't necessarily about volume or scaling up. Instead, it might be enough to just ride the wave, to live within her means, or, as she says,
to be gentle with myself. to understand that we are all somewhere in the world doing our own part.
That was local food writer Jamie Lewis speaking with San Luis Obispo farmer and chef Julie Simon. Lewis will continue to contribute to KCVX with her new segment, Consumed. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCVX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcvx.org.